So we met for what was meant to be 30-minute dinner. It became this like 3.5-hour founder first date. We were actually like kicked out of the restaurant we were at because we spent too long there. And then we had to move to the Starbucks across the street. And it was just instant founder love at first sight.
Welcome to She's Interesting, a podcast about business, money, and well-being for women over 30. I'm your host, Rochelle Hariri. I'm an award-winning marketer, consultant, and startup advisor. Today, I am so excited to introduce you to my incredible guest who has scaled her company, and I have so many questions for her. This is going to be great. Connie Lowe, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Rochelle. I'm super pumped to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here. I've been telling all my girlfriends, Connie Lowe's coming on the podcast. No, I have a list of questions. We're going deep. I'm like leaving no rock uncovered. So let me tell you guys who may not be familiar with Connie Lowe, what she's all about. So Connie Lowe is the co-founder of Three Ships. It's an effective and natural skincare brand focused on transparency that is transforming the clean beauty space with accessible products. We love clean products and She's Interesting. From farm to shelf, each product includes science-backed, plant-derived ingredients, no fillers or chemicals, and is housed in 100% recyclable packaging. So, so good. Three Ships delivers uncomplicated skincare backed by natural ingredients and real science, y'all. Real science. In 2016, a mutual friend introduced Connie to Laura. Both of them were frustrated by the lack of affordable clean skincare on the market. And so they took $4,000 Canadian and they began creating their own formulations in Connie's apartment with the goal to one day create the most transparent natural beauty brand in the world. So fast forward from 2016 to 2017, Three Ships was officially born. Connie manages the retail, sales, people, HR. That's a lot. And investor relations for Three Ships. Connie has many accolades. On the list, we have Forbes 30 Under 30 Class of 2022, winner of the ACE Young Entrepreneur Award 2023, Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year in Ontario, RBC Women Entrepreneur of the Year 2021. Holy smokes. And she appeared on CBC's hit show, The Dragon's Den. That's the Canadian version for those Americans tuning in. So Connie, welcome to the show. You are a badass. I love it. Oh, welcome.
Thank you. It feels so weird hearing it back to me.
I hear that a lot from the guests. Yeah. Where they're like, oh, damn, I've done a lot of stuff in my time.
Yeah, and it's so awkward. Yeah.
But it's, you know, just like, just let it be. Enjoy. Yeah. Enjoy. I love it.
Embrace it.
So based on my research, you've been an entrepreneur from a young age. When you were in high school, you had a business and you even opened the Toronto Stock Exchange. Tell us about that business, how you got started. Where did this entrepreneurial bug come from?
I feel like I've been really dabbling in entrepreneurship since I was a little kid, like even before high school, because my dad's an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So he runs his own cookware company. And I think I went on my first like startup business trip with him when I was 6. He brought me to Brazil. And then I went to like Germany with him. And he would just show me how he sold cookware in different markets and the ways that he would choose his pricing and like the colors of the packaging and everything. And I just fell in love with the idea of starting something from scratch. And also understanding different marketing that you would need according to different consumers. But obviously, I didn't really think that I would start my own company, went to school, was thinking I would work at a large consumer packaged goods company, CPG, and just work my way up to being like a director or a VP of Tresemme. Yeah. That was my goal when I was younger. And then when I was in high school, I dabbled in something called Junior Achievements. Do you know it?
I remember that.
Okay, yeah. So I remember when they came to my class in grade 9 to tell us about JA. And they were like, yeah, you get to run your own company, but you have advisors from the big four accounting firms helping you out. I was like, you know, this is like a fun opportunity, an extracurricular I can put under my belt for university apps. I started in grade 9. I think we made something so small. It was like literally IKEA mugs with candy stuffed in it, wrapped in cellophane, sold it for like $7.
That's
bucks.
Huge.
Like, yeah, that's how you all start, like pretty much trying to get anyone in your school to buy it from you. And then from there, became president of the Junior Achievement like company that I was involved in the next year. And the year after that, present again. So that was kind of like when I started to get into the ideas and the fundamentals of actually running your own company versus just watching my dad do it.
Amazing.
There was a like an essay competition that they had where they were like, what does entrepreneurship mean to you? And I wrote, like I penned this, you know, quick essay about my dad and how I was really inspired by him because my dad came to Canada with less than $2,000 in his bank account from Singapore and had to bring his whole family over and grew up really poor and created this name for himself. Mm-hmm. So I wrote about my experience watching him and learning from him, which ended up making me the winner of this competition. So I was able to ring the TSX opening bell. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I got into entrepreneurship. Then when I was at Queen's University, studied business. So at Queen's, I was involved in the Queen's Entrepreneurs Competition for 3 years. Started as frosh rep, ended up co-chairing the competition. So it's North America's oldest undergrad business plan competition. So that's, again, when I really fell in love with entrepreneurship and starting my own company. But I think during this time, my confidence honestly was not at its highest. Like, I know there's so many listeners that probably can, you know, relate to this.
For sure.
When you're in your early 20s or even before you're 20, like, you're still figuring yourself out. And I remember back then I would compare myself constantly to my peers at Queen's. And like, the Queen's business program is renowned for having a lot of smart kids. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, like, I don't like finance. I don't like, you know, consulting. Like, what am I meant to do? And the idea of entrepreneurship was in the back of my mind, but I didn't have the guts to be like, you know what? I'm not going to go down a traditional career path. I'm going to start my own company. Yeah. So instead, I was like, what's the safest thing I can do? I'm going to go into accounting.
That is very safe.
It is, right?
You're right, yeah.
To be fair, their internship program was bomb. Like, I loved my internship. It was boat parties all the time. It's very different than full-time
That's life.
Then I went full-time. Absolutely hated it. Within a couple of months, I was already like on Indeed and like monster.com or whatever it's called, like trying to find other jobs. Switched to marketing and sales. And then it was during this time I was introduced to Laura, and the rest is history.
That's wild. So, okay, I want to touch a little bit on what you mentioned about confidence. What advice do you have for people who are feeling imposter syndrome as they're getting started? And then also for yourself, how have you seen your confidence change throughout the years? Because you've been running 3 ships for 7 years now.
Oh, man. I think imposter syndrome is a tricky subject because I remember when we first started the company, I was like, okay, once we hit 1 million in sales, then I'm not going to feel imposter syndrome. And then once we hit 5 and once we get into X number of retailers. And then what I realized along the way is, in my opinion, it doesn't ever fully go away, this imposter syndrome, because once you figure out how to deal with one set of challenges and you become an expert at that, you're faced with a whole other set of challenges that you've never encountered before.
Yeah.
And I think like part of imposter syndrome is feeling like you're a fraud at something that you've never tried. But unless you're always trying to stay safe and do something you've never, doing things that you've always done before, you're never going to grow. So in my opinion, it's okay to have some imposter syndrome, but you can keep it in check. So things that I do are, first off, I recognize that no one knows what the heck they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think people hear that a lot, but I don't think people actually believe it.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, like, I'm really fortunate to be in circles now where we are really well connected with CEOs at massive beauty companies or even consumer packaged goods companies and, you know, all like the big people that you'd be like, wow, they definitely know what they're doing. And the number of times I've heard like, I don't know, I just couldn't figure it out. I said yes to these opportunities. I never take no for an answer, but it's not like they were really well funded, well connected. They just decided to go for it. So first thing is you realize no one really knows what they're doing. And I can give you so many stories of that with Laura and my, you know, journey of starting 3 ships. And the second thing is I started to try to make note of the little things that I would do every day that I didn't know how to do in the past. So like I have a log, I have a journal where I write down at the end of the day, like 3 things that went well. And it could be something as small as I held open a door for someone on the way up, you know, to this building to record. Or it could be something as big as, oh my gosh, I landed Whole Foods, an account I never thought we'd be in. But when you reflect on these wins, when you know you have to write them down at the end of the day, as these things are happening to you throughout the day, you're kind of remembering them because you're like, oh, I have to make note of this at the end of the day anyway. So it's forcing you to change your viewpoint in life. Mm-hmm. And B, when you're having a really hard time, you can reflect back on these journal entries. So not only do I have these journal logs, I also screenshot any wins that myself or my team have made along the way. And I actually have them saved in a Google Drive called like My Personal Wins with a Heart. It's very cheesy, but I'll write down like the year and the date of the screenshot and then like a little description of what it was. So I have screenshots in there like our first, you know, customer 5-star review or something like that. And then I have something like, oh, my Indigo buyer gave me really good feedback, and I'll screenshot his email. And when I'm having really hard days, I'll actually open that Google folder and look at it and just kind of click through. And I do this in my annual review too. Like I'm a big fan of reviews.
Yeah.
And I find that this just helps so much because you will always remember the things that you did badly in, but rarely do you remember things that you did well. And it's only up to you to remember those things, especially when you're a founder. You don't have a boss telling you that you did a good job.
Yeah. You have to pat yourself on the back. Yeah.
And like, luckily I have an amazing co-founder. We pat each other like, on the backs, but we don't have like a traditional boss to give us a performance review. So you, at the end of the day, have to be your own cheerleader.
Yeah, I love that. And I do the same thing, to be honest. I screenshot everything and then I have a folder under my She's Interesting drive where I put, for example, all the feedback from season one and everything that people have said, because you're right, especially if you have perfectionist tendencies and you're used to always trying your best and striving for being the best. When you don't have that positive reinforcement, or especially when you're results oriented and you're like, I need that like words of affirmation or whatever it is, it helps so much. And I recommend it to my friends all the time too, which is just save it, because you'll remember the time when you messed something up and you'll have regrets, but you won't remember someone passing by and saying, hey, what you did was amazing. It changed my day.
Oh my gosh, 100%. That's why even as a team, like on a broader level, in our Slack, we have a channel called Positive Reviews where our customer service lead or myself and Laura will like include screenshots of really great reviews. We have a Yay channel where anyone can share like small and big wins. Like we're a really big fan of celebrating the wins, because if you don't, I mean, just life sucks.
That's true.
Everything's just like so gray. Like you need to celebrate.
Yeah. I also think that's really important for the culture of your business, right? Like making sure that everyone's focused on the sunny side of things and the positive side, because if there's a little bit of negativity can grow so quickly. And it's like, hey, this may have not gone well, but everyone look at the bigger picture and what we're actually accomplishing here.
100%. And I think that's something that my co-founder and I have really spent a lot of time on is our culture. And I know we're kind of jumping around here, but culture is so important to us. And like one of our company values is compassion. And even just today when we're at the office, our brand manager, without prompting, she picked up these really cute desserts. And then when our marketing coordinator was like at the bathroom, she pulled out the desserts, put some candles in and was like, I just want to celebrate her helping us to achieve 60,000 followers on Instagram. So when our marketing coordinator came back, we're all like celebrating. She was like, oh, like what are we celebrating? She's like, is it my 1 year anniversary with my boyfriend? We're like, A, we didn't know that, but congrats. But B, like just want to celebrate Instagram. And like, I'm so proud of the culture that we built where like, I didn't know what was going on. Laura didn't know what was going on. And our brand manager, who's only been with us for a month, like inherently knew our company culture to this level where she went out of her way to do this. And like, that makes me so proud as a founder.
So I'm curious, because I'm sure there's people that are listening to She's Interesting and either looking for a co-founder or currently working with one. So first of all, was it founder at first sight when you guys saw each other? And how did you, like, did you have a checklist? How did you determine that this is the right person for me to work with? Because you guys had met through a friend.
Yeah.
So how do you then decide, hey, we just met each other, should we start a business?
I know. I was telling all my friends and family during this time when I was working marketing and sales that I really wanted to start something. And one of my friends I was talking to, he went to university with Laura and he was like, wait, my friend Laura has been talking about wanting to start a skincare company. You're saying you want to start a company. And he remembered that I used to make my own face masks in grade five when we used to go to school.
Grade five?
Yeah, I was like, I was that girl. So he was like, wait, this is like a perfect opportunity. Yeah. Why don't you just meet Laura, talk to her about her minimum viable product. She can show it to you. And then, yeah, we'll see how that goes. Mm-hmm. So we met for what was meant to be 30-minute dinner. It became this like 3.5-hour founder first date. We were actually like kicked out of the restaurant we were at because we spent too long there. And then we had to move to the Starbucks across the street. And it was just instant founder love at first sight. And I think what made this duo so powerful is that we were complete opposites in terms of personality types and skill sets. So that's one piece of advice I have for your listeners is if you're looking for a co-founder, don't try to find someone that's exactly like you, even though that can be very tempting.
Yeah.
You really want to find someone who has different skill sets than you. Otherwise, you're going to have a huge part of the business that's lacking unless you have multiple co-founders. Mm-hmm. So that's my first piece of advice. The second thing that really made us a strong duo is we were completely aligned in terms of values. So we talked about how we were brought up. We talked about our life goals. We talked about things that are really important to us. And so after this 3.5-hour meeting, we're like, whoa, you are complete opposite in terms of me, in terms of like what you like to do. I like the front end side of the business, marketing, sales, customer facing. Laura really likes process-oriented things. She's an engineer by trade and very analytical. But we knew that we could trust each other a lot because we had the same life values. So at the end of that dinner, she turned to me and she was like, do you want to just be my co-founder on this? And I was like, heck yeah. So she was like, take some time to think about it. It's a big decision. You're going to have to invest $2,000. And I was like, wow, that's all I have in my bank account. Yeah. But I was 100% in. And we sometimes get asked like, oh, did you ever feel scared? Or like, how did you know you'd go full time with this one day? And honestly, I never had any doubt that we would go full time with this company. And I don't know what it is. It's just, I believe in us so much. And I believe in her as a co-founder and myself. So we literally got started the next day in my apartment kitchen, like you said.
That's wild. So when you guys first started and you were creating, like doing the product development, did Laura already have some formulations created, or did you come together and say, these are the skin problems we want to solve?
So when she first started, she had gone to Whole Foods and got some like fractionated coconut oil and some essential oils. And she wanted to make a natural makeup remover, but in a wipe format that was actually natural. So she had this, like, I can say it because we both say it's ugly, but it was an ugly brown jar. Yeah. It was a plastic jar with some like hand-soaked makeup rounds with coconut oil and essential oils. So that's what she had. Mm-hmm. And so that's our jumping off point. What we did is we're like, okay, well, let's look at the different skin types out there. There were four main ones that we saw, normal, combination, dry, and oily. We ended up kind of condensing them down to normal to dry, combination to oily, and now we have sensitive skin as well as mature skin. But back then, those were the four. And then we literally used Google. We're like, what are the best essential oils for oily skin? Okay, yeah. Like cedarwood and tea tree. What are the best essential oils for dry skin? And that's how we made our first four SKUs. So our first four SKUs were makeup rounds for different skin types. They were priced at $15, but free shipping if you bought two or more. So for the first couple of months of Shopify sales, our daily sales were either $0 or $33.90. And it was because people would often take advantage of the free shipping if they bought two. So fun fact, next month, Laura and I are actually going to get matching tattoos that say
$33.90. Oh my God.
To be like, oh, so far we've come.
You guys are the best. Where are you getting the tattoo?
It's going to be like your body? Wrist? Okay, so I think it's going to be on my wrist just because...
I'm gonna look it's a good at it reminder. Every
day. Yeah. So I was just like, I just want to make sure it doesn't look like an actual dollar sign though, because I don't want to brand myself with a price. So we're going to have to finesse the way that it looks, but I'm really excited.
That's amazing. You guys are like a founder dream. That's fantastic. Oh, yeah. And so when you are looking back at your journey now, so just for everyone to know, you have a seven-figure business, eight-figure business?
Seven-figure.
Seven-figure business.
We'll be eight by end of year.
There you go. Let's put that in bold. Eight figures by end of this year. So exciting, Connie. When you were first building and getting to the place that you are. Like, let's give everyone an understanding of the reality of your history. It's been 7 years in the making to get here. Yeah. Just like we were saying before, there's a lot of imposter syndrome where people feel like they may just be getting started in their founder journey and they look in the wrong places. They're maybe looking at you guys and saying, oh my God, they're so amazing. They're in all these Whole Foods. They're in over 900 retail locations. Like, how do I even get started? But I think the important thing is for people to realize, as when you're starting as a founder, don't compare your journey to someone that's so far ahead. Compare it to someone who's maybe closer to you. And then maybe also build a community of founders that are in the same space. You can support each other.
Oh my gosh.
But that's one thing I wanted to put out there, because we're celebrating your win and I think that's huge. But for the people that are listening, don't let that discourage you. Know that that could be you in 6-7 years from now.
Oh my God. There's so many things that you just said there that I need to make sure we touch on. Mm-hmm. So first thing is, when we started, we would follow accounts of beauty brands within like color, hair, body, et cetera, that were like 100K plus followers on Instagram. And then that just made us feel like crap, to be honest, because we were like, oh yeah, we are literally hand making these products at night in my kitchen because we have to work our 9-to-5s because we're broke college grads. And then we're selling at farmers markets on the weekend. It's like the least glamorous thing you can ever do. And then we're comparing ourselves to these like shiny brands that have influencer campaigns and like the most beautiful events. And we're like, dang, like that's so far out. Mm-hmm. But then something that we did is there was a brand that we really admired back then. And we went onto their old Etsy page. And I don't know if you could still do this, but we realized that when you click through the orders at the bottom, the URL changes at the top. So if you change the like dash, whatever number it is at the end of the URL, you could actually see what their products look like when they sold their first product.
That's such a good hack.
It was cool. I don't know. Yeah. We were playing around with it. And then we looked at what their product looked like. And this is a brand that is carried at Sephora. And we were like, wow, if they started with craft paper that honestly looks uglier than our current product, then we could do that too. So that's my first piece of advice, is if you are comparing yourself to other brands, try to compare yourself to their first iteration of the company and not the 10th or 20th version of where they are today. Yeah. That's really important. And the second thing you said, Rochelle, is around your circle of people. Mm-hmm. When Laura and I first started, we were thinking that we would want to talk to founders that were really far ahead of us. And then we realized quickly, like, A, we're not really providing that much value to them. And we want to make sure we were always providing value. And B, the advice they were giving us wasn't really that value add for us either, because it was like 5 years ahead of where we were. Like, there's no point telling me how to structure your company for tax savings and, you know, like raising your Series B when we're making products by hand and haven't even made $1,000 in sales. Like, yeah. So you need to make sure that your circle of people is close to you in stage. So Laura and I always tried to have mentor nights with founder friends. Founders with companies that are at our scale or slightly higher than us. And we also mentor founders that are slightly, like, you know, ahead of us in terms of, like, maybe they're a year behind us, but mm-hmm. you want to stick to people around that bubble. And then we still are inspired by brands that are a couple years ahead of us, like Ilya or Kosas, but that's not the only brand that we look to.
That's smart. I think that's really valuable advice and a good way to break it down, because as you were describing this, I was thinking too, bringing the right people into your inner circle as your advisors or whatever it may be, sometimes they're just too far ahead and they lose touch with the fact that, oh yeah, 5 years ago, also it was a different market. Yeah. So their advice may not be valuable anymore. And that actually is a great transition to my next question, because right now in this market, we are seeing a lot of celebrity brands, big name brands that scale too quickly. They got too much investor funding. Yeah. And to be honest, they're being sold for very low value or for parts. What do you feel about what's going on? I mean, beauty has been so saturated for the last few years. What is your advice? What's your take on what's happening in the industry right now?
I remember when all the celebrity brands started popping up within the beauty space. When the first few started popping up, we were like, this is not great because they were taking up all the spots in Sephora and Ulta, or even like other retailers, not just Sephora and Ulta. Mm-hmm. And we were seeing them plastered all over the influencer pages. And we're like, well, we can't afford the budget that they have. Like, I can't pay $10,000 for an influencer to post 3 IG stories. Like, that's just out of the question for us. Then it was interesting because we're like, well, if we can't compete with these celebrity brands in terms of our clout, like, I'm not an influencer or celebrity by any means. I don't have their budgets. What can we do that's different than something like a Rose Inc. Or, you know, like a Selena Gomez brand, Rare Beauty? Mm-hmm. And what Laura and I said is it's really our founder story of starting in our kitchen. It's also us giving advice to other founders, which is why you'll always see Laura and me like hopping on our socials and like sharing the behind the scenes. Customers are so used to seeing our faces. And I think that's way more authentic than some of these celebrity brands, and I won't name names, but they, you know, they'll be there during the product launch campaign, but you kind of know inherently, you feel it, like they're not really in the brand. And
they're not working on it.
No, they're not. They don't care. They don't care about the formula. They don't care about the sub ingredients that go into each ingredient like we do. They're only there for the flashy moments. And our hypothesis was that these brands would eventually go under. And unfortunately, fortunately, like, the brands that are in that camp are starting to disappear. And so I'm really glad that consumers are voting with their dollars, because it was kind of scary at the start.
I can imagine.
And I think that consumers nowadays are just so careful with where they spend their money. And with TikTok now, where there's so much education out there, I think gone are the days where people will buy something just because of the celebrity name. Sure, there are some trend folks buyers that do that. But for the most part, I think that the zeitgeist is shifting.
I absolutely agree. I think the pendulum swings.
Yes.
And at one point it was, and even if you think about to like 2020, 2021, where money in the VC space was just flowing. Everyone, I'd go on LinkedIn every day and it was like, I got a $30 million Series A, or I got a $10 million pre-seed, you know, like crazy valuations.
Like pre-revenue too. And you're like, what?
Like, how do I get this? But anyways, but like more importantly, even at that time, I think as a founder or someone who's just in the industry, it's good to have an understanding of what's happening and to be able to assess these trends. And I think it's great that you guys were able to detach any of that imposter syndrome or feelings of competition with these brands and recognize that we see what's happening. We feel like it's not sustainable or it's not going to last that long, and kind of be heads down and still focused on your mission.
Yeah, I think it kind of reminds me of what we were talking about earlier with even not comparing ourselves to brands that are 5 years out. I always like to say, like, you need to have blinders on, like selective blinders, because you do want to look around and obviously make sure you know what's out there, what's trending, what your competitors are doing. But there comes a certain point where you're like, okay, I got the information I need. Just focus on you, focus on the business. Another piece of advice I have for your listeners is if you're trying to listen to too many different opinions from your friends, from other brands, you're trying to copy too many other brands with their events and their packaging and their messaging, you don't have a brand then. You're kind of just like an amalgamation of a bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. And consumers won't resonate with that. So it's good to get inspo from other brands, but you need to remember what your core values are and double down on that, because that's what actually is going to make you stand out and last long term.
Initially, when you launched, your brand was called New Body. Mm-hmm. And then you guys rebranded into Three Ships, which I know like what the story is behind Three Ships, and I've done all my research. It's fantastic. But what prompted you to change the name? Did you feel like you wanted to completely overhaul the brand and change the community? Or what was the differentiation point for you, and why did you make that change?
So going back all these years to 2017, when we first launched, Laura and I were 23. We had the $4,000 between the two of us to start the company, zero marketing budget. We're like, okay, like, let's think of a brand name. Okay, so our first product line has coconut oil in it. NIU in Hawaiian means coconut. I don't know why we picked Hawaiian, but we're like,
sounds
cute.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. New Body, not a body care company, but we're like, New Body, sounds cute. Let's make that our name.
Yeah.
So it literally took us like 5 seconds to think of the brand name. We're like, yeah, it's cute. It's cute. What we realized really quickly is A, people thought NIU was an acronym. They're like, what does NIU stand for? And we're like, did not think that far. B, they thought it was a body care company. Makes sense. C, and this is something we couldn't have predicted, when you start to search up New Body, in the beginning days, there was a body that was found on Northern Illinois, like, university campus. And so in the beginning days, people would see this article of this person who, like, died on campus.
And that's rough.
Oh my gosh. So luckily, we built up more of a brand name. We overtook that spot on Google. But over time, we're like, okay. The biggest thing was when we launched the brand, we're like, who is going to appreciate affordable skincare the most? Our hypothesis was Gen Z and, like, younger people, because they don't have that much discretionary income, so they need something they can afford. But what we actually realized from looking at our Shopify data for the first 2 years is most of our customers are actually millennials between 25 to 40, 45. And it's because these women are already familiar with natural. They know the quality of our ingredients. And they're like, whoa, your price point is half, if not a third, the price of the other brands I'm using for the same quality or higher. So it's a no-brainer for them to purchase. So this is actually our core base. And when we looked more into what they were looking for from brand messaging, they just wanted transparency. They didn't care about, like, pastel pinks and, like, you know, we used to use phrases like, you go girl, like, you glow on, babe. And things like that.
So like, cringy. That's not the vibe anymore.
No, we would have like bunnies on our packaging. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what Laura and I were doing. So there came a point where we're like, okay, if we're going to change all this stuff about our brand, people are finding New Body confusing. Let's just do a whole overhaul. And it was really scary, Rochelle, because we had built up 3 years by that point of brand equity. Mm. And we were like, you know what? There's going to be a point we need to rip off the Band-Aid right now.
Yeah. And might as well do it now.
Yeah. So it took us like 6 months of work thinking of the new brand name, thinking of the new product colors, product packaging, thinking of what products we want to phase out versus keep. And then it was during the time of COVID. So we were about to launch. COVID happened. Laura was diagnosed with a brain tumor. She was out of commission for a couple of months going through surgery. Then BLM, and then we eventually launched Three Ships in July of 2020. And fun fact is, when we were on Dragon's Den, that was before our brand had actually even launched as Three Ships. So we only had one set of product samples, and that's what we brought on set.
Oh, wow. You guys went on Dragon's Den. You had one of the Dragon's Gym offer you, it was like a royalty deal.
Yeah.
How did that help your business? Understanding that you didn't end up working with him in the end, and you guys ended up raising your seed round. What was that? How did that process actually help you? Were you guys prepared for this like chart that would skyrocket in terms of your sales? How did you prepare from a business perspective? I think a lot of the questions that I see online are people saying like, how did you prepare for your Dragon's Den pitch? Yeah. But I actually want to know how you guys prepared behind the scenes for your business.
I love that. A, you're so well researched to like know everything that happened. And B, you're right. I get the question a lot of like, how did you prep to go on the show? But there was so much prep work that happened after the show. So behind the scenes, what happens is you don't actually know if your episode is going to air until they told us 2 weeks. Oh, no, they told us, maybe a week and a half before the episode went live.
Wow.
So you really don't know. And B, you don't get to see the episode before it goes live. So when we did our viewing party, was the first time we even saw what would happen. And C, what a lot of people don't know is they make you sign away your rights before you go on. So you sign this line that's like, we reserve the right to embarrass you and change the narrative of what happened into something that might not have happened. So I've had founders say that they went on the show and, you know, they made cuts to make it look like they reacted in a negative way to something the Dragon said when that didn't end up happening. Because at the end of the day, it's reality TV. And like, no knock to Dragon's Den. I love the show.
Yeah.
But this is, these are all things that go on behind the scenes that you need to be aware of if you're thinking of going on Dragon's Den. So once they told us that we were going to air, this was right in the middle of our fundraise too. So Laura and I were already working around the clock fundraising. We had to create a virtual viewing party in a week and a half because it was during COVID, couldn't do in person. So the first thing we did is we wrote up a bunch of blog posts because no ChatGPT back then either. So we had to write blog posts by hand to boost our SEO because we were thinking if someone Googles Dragon's Den, three ships, we want to be the first link that would come up so people could shop us. So we wrote a bunch of articles. One was actually talking about how we prep for Dragon's Den. So if someone listening wants to know, just search up Dragon's Den, three ships, and you'll see our whole behind the scenes of how we got ready for the taping. B, we created a Dragon's Den collection on our site. So we created a Dragon's Den bundle of products that the Dragons tried on air and discounted it. So if someone was new to the brand, which many people going on our site that night were new to the brand, they'd be able to pick up some products. C, what we also did is we shared the news with like pretty much anyone in our circle, whether it was like a potential investor, buyers, founder, friends, and we just told everyone to blast it out and use the same link. So we want everyone to go to the same CBC season 15 episode 2 link because we wanted to show CBC that we were like one of the best episodes that they had.
Smart move.
And I don't know what ended up like working out, whether it was that or like the amount of buzz around the brand. But what I do know is we ended up being one of the episodes they picked to be on all Air Canada flights for a year. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. Change your homepage. So it's an image. They'll send you a few screenshots of the episode. So change your homepage to be Dragon's Den related because if someone is watching Dragon's Den and isn't familiar with your brand and they Google your company, they click on your homepage, they might not know if they found the right brand that Dragon's Den was talking about. So you want to make sure your homepage is Dragon's Den branded. So everyone's like, okay, I found the right company.
Yeah, as seen on.
Keep the badge on there. We also did a bunch of sponsored ads, which I forgot to mention. So sponsored ads.
That's a great tip.
A bunch of IG posts, sent out email to all of our followers telling them to watch the episode. So little things like that.
Were you able to forecast or predict? Like, did you say we think we're going to get like a 50% increase in sales or purchasing?
Yeah. So we talked to a couple of founders who had been on Dragon's Den before to hear from them what sales that they saw. And then another thing we also kept in mind is people were watching throughout Canada at different times throughout the night. So like East Coast started earlier, then Toronto played at, I'm making this up, 9 p.m. And then Vancouver played at like 11 or something. So what we decided to do is we had four people on our team at the time. All four of us were on customer service that night. So while we were doing the live viewing party, we were already manning the bots or like the customer chat being like, oh, like, you know, you found the right site. Like this is the bundle. Because we got so many questions coming in being like, you know, is it all natural? Can I buy, like, is this good for my skin type? Yada, yada. So make sure you have manpower, people power, managing the customer service. And B, I think we over forecasted because we had heard people say like, oh, you're going to see like a massive spike in sales. What I will tell you is when we track the cohort of people that started to shop three ships within that 2 week period of the episode airing, that cohort is one of our most loyal cohorts still. But the initial bump up in sales wasn't as big as what I was thinking. I think maybe we did like $10,000 in sales the next day, which for the size of a company back then, it was big. But, you know, to us now, it's pretty small.
What are some of the effective ways that your team has been able to ensure that these customers are coming back and repurchasing? Obviously, like the product is at the core. It's got to be good for people to buy. But let's say in addition to the product, is it, you know, like your email marketing or your social, like what have you guys done to have such incredible numbers?
Oh man, I feel like this could be like a days long episode because this is,
she'll be back.
Yeah. This is like the number one thing we care about. I mean, that and profitability, like profitability, it's our number one North Star, which I'm really proud to say we are a profitable company. And we're also first order profitable. So if you want to scale your online advertising, like you need to make sure your LTV to CAC is strong, but that's like a whole other conversation. When it comes to repeat rates, product, like you said, is most important because mm-hmm. I can do whatever fluffy marketing or like the most effective marketing out there. But if the product doesn't work, you're not going to come back.
Yep.
I think it's the most important thing. On top of that, you want to make sure you incentivize trials. So I think we do a great job of social proof online. And we're always thinking like, if I were a new customer to the brand and I go on the homepage or I go on the PDP for this bestseller, like what do I see? Mm-hmm. So the before and afters have to be strong. We have our 30-day refund policy like really clearly laid out. So if someone tries it, even if they've opened it and used it, it's like half full, they didn't like it after 30 days, no questions asked. We'll pay for their shipping label to return it back to our warehouse. It gets destroyed. And then it's like literally no risk for them. So I think that's really important because when you're trying something online, you can't smell, touch, and feel the product like you can in person. On that point, it was really important for us from day one to be a true omnichannel brand. Mm-hmm. So being available in-store and online, because our hypothesis, which was proven to be correct, is within skincare, if you're a new brand, you want people to be able to trial you in person and you want to piggyback off of the reputation of these amazing retailers like Whole Foods that are known for having very strict standards. And then when someone buys a product in person, we actually have a post-purchase survey online to see where did you hear about us. And I think about half of the people that buy online, that number might be a little inflated, but around half actually discovered us through a retailer. So we really think as like one business, and I think advice to other founders out there that have retail partners, don't try to like be really protective of your e-com and just funnel everyone there because your margins are higher, because it really is a flywheel effect. Whether someone finds you in store and then buys you online, or they first hear about you online on an Insta ad, aren't convinced, and then see you in store at like Halt Renfrew, it's all one business. And mm-hmm. that's also why we're so supportive of our retailers whenever they have promotions. Like I'm very on top of them being like, what days are the promotions? We'll post about on IG stories, email, et cetera. And I think that all feeds into like the repeat rate because like you're just everywhere for the customer.
Yeah.
Another thing is we listen to our customers when it comes to product launches. So we will never launch a product just for the sake of launching something new. Mm-hmm. Instead, we'll ask them, what is it that you want? So the next product that we have launching, which I know you mentioned this season doesn't air until March, so our product will have launched by then. It's an eye cream. And it's been one of our most requested products to date. That tied with an SPF, which is in the works. So we're not just going to like make an eye cream and just release it. We'll ask our audience, what texture do you want? What skin benefits do you want to give you? What's your skin type? What price point are you willing to pay for it? What format do you want? Do you want to be in a jar? Do you want to be in a tube? We take all of this information. We create several different versions of each formula. We send it out to real customers to try. And then if we see any consistent negative feedback come back to us in the survey, we actually scrap the formula and start again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so iterative.
How long is this process?
It takes like, okay, depends. If we like nail the formula on the first try, maybe 8 months.
Yeah.
But usually it takes over 12 months. Like at the eye cream, I think we're working on for 12 to 14 months. The SPF, we're on our 13th iteration of the formula and still not ready. And we're not going to launch it until we feel like it's 100% there. But that's like a big part of how we've been able to have such a strong repeat purchase rate and reorder rate, because people trust us. And we're creating products they actually want to try. So
this is a great reminder that product innovation takes time. Oh, it's not like when I work a lot with B2B companies, and that stuff takes time too, like creating, working with engineers and product developers. But when you're creating a consumer product, it takes time. It takes months. Everything from, like you said, the formulation to the actual packaging to the way things are, even testing it for shipping, right? Like depending on the bottle that you put it in, is your shipping rate going to be more expensive? All of these things factor into then you saying, this is our finished product. This is the margin on the product. And from a business perspective, we're now ready and we think consumers are going to like this. So I love the way that you've broken down the process of building these products and sampling them and having your customers involved where you're getting that feedback and you're making these different iterations. Actually, I want to say that one of my favorite products of yours is the Brighter Days Under Eye Biodegradable Under Eye Masks. I was downtown, so this is more of like an anecdote. I was downtown last year when you guys had just launched it and I bumped into Connie on the street and she was doing, remember that? You were doing the detox market.
I forgot about that. You were with a friend.
Yeah. We were, I think we were like, the bagel place.
And then we bumped into you
and she was carrying a tray of sushi and she was like, hey, we're doing an event. You guys should come.
Again, founder scrappiness.
Like, there you go.
Didn't send someone else to do it. Picked it up myself.
And I that really stood out to me because even though your company has grown so much and you have so much success, you are still a boots on the ground type of founder. And you were there, you were talking about the product, you were explaining how it works. And that also, to me, made me like your brand even more, because I was like, Connie's still in it. She still gets it. She's like listening to our feedback, showing us how things work. Yeah. And it was really good. So I love that you do that.
Even on like the retail side, you know, I think everyone has their own unique gifts and strengths. And I would say one of mine is relationship building. And with buyers, like even when they say something small, for the example of when I was in New York, I was visiting a Credo store, a detox market store, and the store manager was getting into running. And she was like, yeah, next month I'm going to go for this like zombie race. It was around Halloween. And I was like, wow, it's super exciting. Like, what happens there? And she's like, oh, like people dress up as zombies and they chase you and it's a 5K. And I'm like, yeah, that's like legit. And then when we left the coffee, I took a note on my phone. I'm like, message her on October 29 to be like, good luck for your upcoming race. Like little things like that. And, you know, a lot of people think as a founder, you're not involved in the business anymore. But when you do those little things, like the little moments that remind people that you care about them, those go so far. And I love doing things like that. And again, I think that's what's led to our brand manager today buying a cake impromptu for her team member. Like, it's the little things, the little moments that people remember. What's that quote? Like, people won't remember what you did or what you said, but they'll always remember how you made them feel.
Yes.
And that's how I always try to lead as a founder. Mm-hmm. And I think as part of that, you need to still be involved in the day-to-day, be at the events, talk to the customers. I still get every single customer review sent to my inbox. So I don't filter those out. Laura also reads every single review because we want to be involved. Have you seen the movie The Intern with Anne Hathaway?
Yeah. Yes.
It's like one of my favorite movies. Do you remember the scene where she goes to the warehouse to see how they packed it out because she like ordered from her own site and realized like the packing was really bad? Like that's me and Laura as founders to a nutshell. Like, it's not the micromanaging aspect, less so that. It's more we want to make sure that our finger is always on the pulse, because if you let go too quick, things can really go downhill really fast.
I really like that you guys are still involved, because I think that's what's helping you to continuously grow and scale. And like you said, you have your finger on the pulse. You understand what your customers want. I feel like what happens with some brands is they get to the stage where they feel like, oh, well, I'm a founder of a seven-figure business now. I need to think differently and I need to level up and do X, Y, and Z. And I think at the core, what some of these brand founders forget is that community is everything.
Oh my gosh,
and your community is what's creating your repeat purchase or creating that long-term valued customer. And when you lose sight of that, your business starts to, some of the foundations start to crumble. And so I really appreciate that you guys are still to this day, eight figures by the end of the year, you know, grabbing those sushi plates and walking over to the detox market.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And I think it also sets a good example for the team, because we never want them to forget the scrappiness of our founding story. And even though we're scaling certain things, like our iCream launch event, it's the first time we're ever going to work with another agency to run an event. Up until this point, we've done everything ourselves. And even though we're spending, you know, a lot of money on this event, I always want to remind my team, whatever you can do yourself that isn't taking like forever, you should try to do it yourself. Like, don't lose that part of our DNA. But on the flip side of that, because we've been so focused on doing things ourselves for the longest time, as founders, something that I'm trying to work on, and I know Laura is too, is learning to delegate. So there's a difference between showing your face all the time as a founder and being involved in your community and not letting go of things that you should empower your team to do. So today, as an example, our director of marketing messaged me on Slack. She's like, hey, do you want to be involved in the holiday kit naming and copy? And I'm like, no. And I was like, period. I was like, oh my God, it was so like
liberating.
And then she replied and she was like, that made me cackle and laugh out loud, because like, it's just like a no. And she's like, I totally hear you. Yeah. And it was hard for me to say no to that, because I do want to be involved. I want to be involved in naming a seasonal kit. That's so fun.
Yeah.
But where my time is better spent is being involved in community, being on this podcast, sharing our story with others. So working on the business and less working in it.
I want to know, you've grown from a zero figure to a four figure to a five figure, six figure, seven figure, and now going into an eight figure business. What are the differences as a founder who is running like a startup 4 to 5 figure business to getting to where you are? How do you almost like fire yourself and level up?
That's a hard question.
I know. This is a long one.
I feel like I'm still figuring that out. I think in the beginning, you say yes to every opportunity. So even if, you know, we didn't have the time, we didn't have the capacity, FabFitFun says they want a 15,000 unit order back when you're making everything by hand and it takes you a minute to make a product. You say yes. When you're working in your parents' basement, you're shipping out of your parents' basement, you're doing Black Friday out of there, you say yes. Then now that you're at the point where you're at 7-8 figures, that's when, or even before 7-8 figures, I would say, is when you have to start saying no to things. Mm-hmm. And that's how I fired myself as a founder. Because if I say yes to every opportunity, I'm not showing up for the things that matter and I'm not showing up for the things that are most impactful. So I actually have a note on my phone. So cheesy. It says things I have said no to with a heart. So it's nice. And I actually document everything I've said no to throughout the year. So if it's a speaking engagement, a panel, having someone pick my brain, things like that, I'll actually document it. And I actually heard this on another podcast. And the reason you do this is at the end of the quarter or the year, you look back at this note and you reflect back on all the time that you saved and what you were able to do in the time that you saved. And also what I add on to that is, do I regret saying no to any of the things I said no to? So far, I haven't. And so I think that this is one of the ways I've leveled up as a founder. As opposed to in the past, I would say yes to everything. If someone asked for 30 minutes of my time to pick my brain, I would hop on a call with them or meet them in person. From there, I kind of scaled it back to, I can't meet you in person. Let's do a call. Scaled that back to, send me your questions via email. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. And then now I kind of like point them to different blogs I've written and things like that. Something I heard from Tim Ferriss is, if you find yourself saying the same thing more than once, you should document it somewhere and send that. So that's one of the biggest ways I think I've evolved as a founder, going away from ruinous empathy, which is, have you read Radical Candor? It's really good. So I was very much in the quadrant of being someone very much in the ruinous empathy mode.
I feel you on that.
And being caring less about sounding nice and having people like me, and way more about being direct but still compassionate. So that's something that for this next stage as a founder, I think it's my number one focus.
I think that's beautiful. I love the no list. I'd never heard of that. And I think it's great. And I also feel like, especially for when you get to a certain stage of your business, it's nice to be able to look back and say, wow, I am in demand. My business is in demand. And I'm able to take control and say no to opportunities now versus chasing them. And I think that's like a mind shift in a way. It's kind of like when you, let's say if you were overweight as a child and then you lost weight, and when you grow up, you still feel that way.
Right.
And you don't realize like, hey, I have a six pack right now. Like that's kind of like, as a founder, you still feel like your early days, but you have to realize like, no, I'm running a big company. I can't do these things anymore.
Totally. And I think it's all about the grace with which you say no.
Yes.
So if someone asks me for my time, I'll always, like, if I need to say no, I'll say it in a really kind way. If someone has a speaking engagement, I'll say no, but recommend 3 other people within my network that might be like interested. If they, you know, ask me to do a speaking thing 1 year, I might say no this time, but be like, tell me when it is next year if I'm free. Mm-hmm. And if it aligns with my schedule, I'll come. So I think it's really about like how you treat people. Again, people will remember how you made them feel. Mm-hmm. They're not going to remember if I went to an event or not.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And so here's my final question before we wrap up. And I ask this to all my guests, which is, what is your money mindset and how has it evolved throughout the different stages of being an entrepreneur?
Ooh, that's a great question. Okay, so I think I used to have a scarcity mindset around money. Mm-hmm. Growing up really poor. You know, my parents like were always shopping at like the cheap discount grocery stores, and we'd like go to the back of the grocery store getting the really like old produce and stuff. So trying to shift from that mentality into running this 7-8 figure business, it was a lot to think about overnight. Mm-hmm. And when we first started, I would be like really cheap with myself about things. So I remember when we first started the company, I had no money. We weren't paying ourselves a salary for a couple of years. So I was eating like a lot of ramen, a lot of pasta. For Christmas 1 year, I like made products by hand for my friends and like bought beauty kits from Sephora and like broke them up for my friends, which made me feel really embarrassed. And there was a lot of shame around money. I think now how I've evolved is I've started to, I mean, A, you start paying yourself a salary, which obviously helps.
It helps for sure.
But B, I'm trying to remind myself that it's cliche, but if you don't fill up your own cup, you can't be there for other people. Mm-hmm. So it's been really hard for me, but letting myself like treat myself to a latte and like not getting the tea because it's cheaper. Like that was something that honestly took me a couple of years to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
And luckily I have an amazing support system. And my husband in particular has been a big cheerleader of ours. So he's always the one's like, spend more on yourself. Like, do
treat
yourself.
Yeah.
And so I think that's like the biggest way it's shifted is less scarcity mindset. and more like, okay, I'm going to spend more on myself and I know opportunities will come my way.
Yeah.
And honestly, it has opened a lot of doors, because when you spend more on yourself, even if it's little things, you carry yourself differently. You mm-hmm. open yourself up to new opportunities. Your confidence builds. Your team sees that too. Yeah. So I would say like scarcity mindset is something that I know a lot of people struggle with, especially yeah. when you're a new founder. But you just need to remind yourself to spend on the little things that make you feel better and help you practice self-care, mm-hmm. Because that's how you avoid burnout and that's how you are in this for the long term.
Absolutely. Those are some really great tips. And I think everyone listening today is going to take away a lot from this conversation, because Connie kept it real with us. She uh-huh. talked about everything. You gave some really incredible and detailed tips, which I think everyone's going to appreciate. So I hope you all had your notebooks out or you're going to listen to this again. But I want to just thank Connie for being on the show today. Thank you so much for being a guest and for being so open about your journey. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much, Rochelle. And thanks for being so well-researched. That's awesome.
I do what I do. Thank you. Thanks as always to our listeners for supporting She's Interesting. Don't forget to subscribe, to rate, and review this incredible podcast. Also, be sure to follow us on Instagram, on TikTok, sign up for our newsletter, and just keep in touch and let me know what you want to see next.